You're listening to the Courageous Life Podcast, helping you develop courage and resilience in a perilous and unpredictable world. This is your host, Sean Mitzel. I'm coming to you from the mountains of northern Idaho. I'm glad you're with us. On today's podcast in the Worldview segment, Monica and I continue to discuss adoption. This is actually part three of that. And in the main segment, I discuss the Argentine Great Depression, and then we look at some parallels and some lessons learned from that event. On today's Worldview segment, we're continuing our discussion on adoption. This is part three, and I'm sitting here with Monica, and we're talking about our adoption. And in the first two parts, we talked about why we adopt, and then secondly, some of the parameters, things like how to choose a country, how to choose an agency, parameters of the children, those kinds of things. Today, what we're talking about is expenses. So where should we start, Monica?
How about preparing for adoption in advance if you know that that's something that you're going to be pursuing financially?
Okay, so like the fact that we made a decision to do it and we decided we would live below our means. Not within, but below our means in order to save. Because for us, we wanted to do it cash.
Yes, we wanted to remain debt-free.
We were not going to borrow money to do it.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, and I think that's important. First of all, we know that when we're going to get more children, the expense of even our monthly bills.
Right. Food, for example.
Right. And clothing. I mean, those things raised significantly when we added four children.
Yes.
I mean, that more than doubled our family with kids. So we already knew that if we didn't get used to living below our means at that point, it was going to be a huge adjustment when the children came. The other was that it really, for us, it was quite expensive.
It was very expensive. And that's just the reality of adoption. That's not to discourage anyone.
Yeah.
It's just to prepare them.
Yeah. That it's not financially cheap, and it is going to require sacrifice in a lot of different ways, but financially is one of them.
And I think one of the things that we did is that we built up the capital ahead of time.
Yeah.
I mean, we really did. We lived below our means for quite some time and saved up. Now, not that we had every single penny saved prior to kickoff.
Right.
But nearly so.
We did. Well, at least at what we thought we would need for, you know, what we thought we would need.
Yeah.
We had all of that. And what helped us was that with all of the required background checks, medical things, our psychological exams and all of that, getting all those types of appointments, getting the paperwork back from all the states and the FBI and those types of things took quite a while.
Yeah.
And we talked about this, that's sort of the nickel and dime.
Yes, that's the nickel and dime portion for sure. It's $50 here, it's $75 there.
Right, and in some cases, $250.
You know, whatever.
Yeah. And then you're paying for, you know, postage on top of that.
Right, and it's not stamps. It's like, oh, you need to get this information there quickly.
Yeah, like overnight or whatever. Right. So we were FedExing things, which that was crazy expensive too. But so that was sort of our nickel and diming, and we had that no problem. But during that time was when we were really...
Bearing down, sacrificing. And it is a sacrifice.
It is. And every single month, you know, we were like, okay, we can take this out. This is a non...
Right. Do you remember the fiscal fast?
Yeah. We did fiscal fasts, yeah, where we decided every month to only do necessities.
Yeah. Right. It was like, no, there's no eating out. There's no getting a coffee here or there.
No soda, nothing. And even to the point of gas. I mean, like, we didn't drive places we didn't need to go.
It was the only absolute necessities. It was the food that we had to buy and those kinds of things.
Well, and the thing is, expenses. Like, during those months, we walked a lot. We walked a lot of places.
Yeah.
We really did because it didn't require gas, and there were a lot of places that in Okinawa you could walk to, and it was a free thing once you got there, whether it was the beach or some caves or whatever. So we took advantage of that and not spending any money but still being able to explore some of the areas.
Yeah. One of the things that we did and that we recommend people do is you come up with alternative ways to make money.
Yeah, make some extra money.
Or save money. You know, either way, like I said, the fiscal fast was the saving money, and then we made extra money.
Yeah. We did pet sitting.
Yeah.
which for us ended up being, we had pets almost every day.
Yeah.
And sometimes two.
Yeah, I would estimate that we made, and we probably were able to put away about $4,000.
Yeah.
Just pet sitting.
Just pet sitting for that year.
Yeah.
Because we only did it for 1 year.
Right.
And it was until we got our first child, so.
Right. And then you get to the, so there's the saving of money, there's the living below your means, there's the trying to make extra money, and then you get to the rough part, which is where the agency bills come due.
Yeah.
That didn't come right away.
It didn't. Matter of fact, it was months when the first big bill came. Now, for a home study, we did have to pay a chunk of money for the home study, but the first really big bill came after we selected the children. And once they were pushing that paperwork forward, it was like, oh, here is this, and it's due before we'll push this paperwork forward. So before we'll put in the things that are required over,
right,
for this next 8 months for it to start moving,
yeah,
you have to pay us.
Yeah, there was
a large chunk.
Kind of like looking at, there were certain gates that you had.
Yes.
Once you got to a certain gate, it required a chunk of money.
Yeah.
And then they would open that gate and you go to the next gate.
Right.
But it was, in that way, I guess it was good in that it was spread out over a year or whatever. Or
right.
Well, all of this was spread out over a couple of years, but it was the little nickel and dime stuff, and then it was kind of the chunks. The big chunks came over a year, pretty much.
Yeah, but we did have that one bulk payment of $11,000 due,
right.
And we didn't realize that it was going to be that big. Now, fortunately, we did have it at that point, but I remember going, whoa,
yeah,
like,
yeah,
that's huge, $11,000.
It was tough.
Yeah.
Now, let's just go ahead and give them an approximate number for our entire Philippines adoption. This includes all the nickel and dime stuff up front, the major agency fees, and the travel and all that.
All the plane tickets for us and the children.
Immigration on the backside, because, of course, that's not inexpensive.
Right, the hotel stay, because we were there for, for 2 weeks.
Yep. We had to rent a vehicle.
Yeah. There was a lot of things that we had to do, and we had to pay the in-country facilitator.
Right.
All of that. So it ended up being around $30,000.
Yes. Yes. Now, obviously, that's we adopted three children from the Philippines.
Yeah.
And so that number is not, I want to say that is probably in the average, certainly for three children.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then, of course, when we picked up the children, we were in the Philippines still for several days after that. So you're talking food and hotel.
That kind of added to our expenses. So we could have stayed under 30, but we had to stay there for
longer. Yeah.
So it's not easy.
No, it's not. Well, and the other thing that added to that expense was that when we got back to the United States, we had to hire a lawyer in order to finalize the adoption, because they don't do that in the Philippines. They don't finalize it. You have the children for 6 months, and then you're also paying for follow-up visits every other month for the first 6 months, and then you have to do the adoption. And so, you know, we had all that on top of that.
Right. You're right. So, like Monica just said, all of that together was right around $30,000.
Yeah.
Okay. So again, that's not to discourage anyone. That's just to prepare them for the harsh reality that it is. And you really got to bear down.
You do. And like Dave Ramsey said, you have to go at it with gazelle-like intensity.
Absolutely. That's great.
It has to be worth it.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's totally doable.
Yeah.
It's just, you just got to put your head down.
Yeah, you have to be committed.
Very committed.
Yep.
On today's podcast, I want to talk to you about an historical era. Now, the reason that we discuss historical eras, so that we can learn from them, obviously, but also that we can understand what was occurring at that time, gain a deeper appreciation for those things that cause maybe hard times, or whether it be economic troubles or government collapse, whatever the case may be. There's many different historical eras that we can look at to gain insight from. So, for example, there's three that are often talked about, and that is the Great Depression. So that obviously occurred in the U.S., and that was began in 1929 and lasted for over a decade. There was the Balkans, you know, the Bosnian ethnic issues and economic problems due to the war-torn era from 1992 to 1995, and then the Argentine Great Depression of 1998 to 2002. So again, another one lasting well over a decade. And that's actually the one that we're going to talk about today, is the Argentine Great Depression, and specifically what we can learn from it. So we'll talk about some of the parallels, and then at the end we'll hit some lessons learned. What's also important to understand about looking at a historical era, which, by the way, is not something that we often do anymore. We really just don't look at history that much, other than names, dates, places, which is really such a small part of history and why we are doomed to repeat it. But, you know, if you look at authors such as John Steinbeck, and he wrote often about Great Depression era and The Grapes of Wrath and Of Mice and Men. These are great books to read, not just to get through as in, you know, a book to read, but to gain lessons learned, to understand that era, that time, and then how it applies to us today. So that's what we're going to look at today, but from an Argentine perspective. The Argentine Great Depression lasted from 1998 to 2002. Now, just a quick word on economic depression, because this is important because we need to define our terms. As opposed to just being called an extreme form of recession, it's generally characterized by its length. An abnormally large increase in unemployment, fall in the availability of credit due to banking or financial crisis, shrinking output, obviously a dry up of buyers and suppliers are cutting back, all these types of things. Increased number of bankruptcies, reduced trade, often accompanied by a devaluation in currency, and bank failures oftentimes. Okay, so let's get to a quick definition. And this is based on the National Bureau of Economic Research. So there's generally two rules when it comes to defining an economic depression. Okay, the first is it's a decline in real GDP exceeding 10%. And of course, that gets into how you define GDP and all of that, but let's just stick with the basics for now. A decline in real GDP exceeding 10%, or a recession lasting two or more years. Okay, and a recession is just generally a decline in GDP for more than or two quarters or more. Okay, so that's just generally speaking, think of that as definition one, definition two. So definition one, GDP decline 10% or more. Definition two, recession lasting two or more years. So a good example for us would be to look at the U.S. Great Depression just for a minute here. So if we use the second definition, so a recession lasting two or more years, then most economists would refer to the Great Depression as the period between 1929 and 1941. Okay, so, and the first definition would then have started in August of 1929 and lasted until March of 1933. All right, so that's generally speaking an example that we can use. Now, back to the Argentine example, the Argentine Great Depression. All right, so what are we talking about here? We are talking about Argentine's GDP declining greatly, debt restructuring. We're talking about 50% of Argentines were poor and 25% indigent. Okay, so just for your edification, indigent is lacking food, clothing, and other necessities of life. Because of poverty. Okay, let's just put that in context. As opposed to, let's say, today's U.S. poor, which are not indigent. They are not lacking in food, clothing, and other necessities of life. Okay, the vast majority of the U.S. poor does not suffer from lack of food. And they actually, in many cases, in the high percentages, suffer from things like obesity and health problems, more so than a lack of food or clothing. Okay, so that's what we're talking about. We're talking about major financial struggles, much of the population. So again, 50% were poor and 25% indigent. So that 7 out of 10 were poor, essentially. Okay, so that's 75% were either indigent or poor, and poor would be something a little bit less than indigent, but think of it as barely making it. Okay, so this was just very, very challenging. And so there's a lot of lessons learned here, and you'll see those throughout as we talk through the Argentine Great Depression. So you had some kind of commonalities. So it was the economy that was consistently in trouble. Their currency was continually being devalued. So in other words, it had inflation and hyperinflation on multiple occasions. You had a collapse of government on multiple occasions. You had massive debt and the restructuring of that debt. All those kinds of things were common during this era for them. And we will see some parallels to how we are sitting right now as the United States. But we have a couple of major advantages, mainly in that we have the world's reserve currency and the petrodollar, which is very much related to the reserve currency. Okay, so for many years, Argentina's had a military dictatorship. They had significant economic problems even prior to this, but nothing to this degree. So they did struggle even in the 70s and 80s with this continual change of power. You had military dictatorships alternating with kind of neoliberal economic platforms and somewhat short-lived periods, I guess, of democratic governments. But mainly the country centered themselves around anti-labor things like that. So they had a lot of problems, essentially. So now democracy was restored in the 80s, and so in 1983 they democratically elected the president at that time. And this new government intended to stabilize the economy. And of course, that was their attempt, and that was how they got elected. It was in order to stabilize the economy. So they introduced austerity measures and a new currency. Now, this gets important. So at this time, it was called the Austral. And obviously, that didn't last because they're back to the peso now. They attempted this. The problem, though, is that it wasn't backed by anything. Okay, so it immediately started to inflate, or I should say devalue. And so it was averaging 10% inflation per month, over 200% a year. And this just spiraled out of control. And in fact, inflation reached 200% for the month in July of 1989. Okay, peaking at 5,000% for the year. So this was, again, an example of hyperinflation. It does happen. It can happen. And this led to a lot of riots and massive instability. And the president resigned. So his plan for stabilizing the economy failed. He resigned. That brings us to the 1990s. And there was another bout of hyperinflation because the next guy in line also tried to stabilize the economy. And he fixed the value of Argentine currency at actually 10,000 Austral to one U.S. dollar. So again, it was some type of method of trying to stabilize the currency. And they did it by somewhat fixing it to the dollar, which even today, a lot of countries do that. It is successful to a degree, to the degree that our dollar is stable, and it is relatively stable. Although, you know, there again, there's always the chance that, especially if we lose world reserve currency status, that the dollar will destabilize. In fact, it really is not all that stable now. It's just the fact that there's still confidence in it is the reason why it is working. Now, this reduced inflation sharply and preserved the value of the currency, so it did work for a time. This led to an increase in the quality of life. Imported goods were increasing, interest rates were stabilizing and becoming more in traditional ranges. Okay, so it had the effect of reducing the cost of imports, which of course made them increase. And Argentina at that point was doing better. It still had a massive external public debt that it had to deal with, but there was a stabilizing effect. But government spending remained very high and corruption was rampant. Okay, so again, we see some trends that generally lead to instability. And so Argentina's public debt grew enormously during the 90s. And the problem there was that it was showing that it was unable to service that debt. So it was increasing debt, government spending was out of control, and then there was no confidence in their ability to service that debt. The IMF kept lending money to Argentina and extending its payment schedules. There was a massive tax evasion because, of course, that led to higher taxes, higher and higher taxes. And at some point, people just stop paying taxes, or they try and evade it at some point. If a government increases taxes to the point that people can no longer sustain it, they will evade it. Money laundering became a common movement of funds towards offshore banks and, of course, massive corruption in the government. And there was much accusation that the central bank and members of the board of directors of the central bank had overlooked the money. Basically, they were turning a blind eye to this. So again, corruption. Argentina's financial system was basically starting to decline and starting to crack under the pressure. You know, at the same time, other Latin American countries like Mexico and Brazil, they also faced economic crises of their own. So this led to a regional mistrust and a regional downturn in the economy. And in 1999, the exports of Argentina were basically shot by the devaluation of the Brazilian real against the dollar. So all these things kind of started working together to create the perfect storm. And Argentina's GDP declined by 3% in 1999. And this entered what became a three-year-long recession. So remember, technically, at this point, depending on how you define depression, they're in a depression already as early as 1999. And even before that. Okay, so they got rid of the austral. So again, the currency was scrapped at this point, and they brought back the peso. And what they did is they linked the peso to the dollar, one-to-one convertibility. And at this point, unemployment had been creeping up. It was all the way up to 15%. You had this lingering recession, or really depression, and continuing high levels of borrowing. So the government did not stop spending, despite talking about austerity measures. They really didn't. So the economic stability in 99 became stagnation and deflation at times. So you had this kind of ping-pong effect between deflation and inflation. And the economic measures taken to avert this did not work. They were not working. So the government, you know, continued its same economic policies, really had nothing new to throw at it. They devalued the peso by abandoning the exchange peg to the dollar. Okay, so at some point they had to de-link this, and that's what they did. And it was a recipe for economic disaster. So, because again, the peso was not backed by anything, and the confidence was low, so it was going to fail. And by the way, the only reason that a fiat currency is stable is due to confidence. That's it. It's not backed by anything. It's just confidence. We trust that the dollar is going to be worth, generally speaking, what we would think a dollar is worth tomorrow, and that's why we use it. But what happens consistently is alternate currencies will pop up. Okay, an underground market will pop up, or a black market, whatever you want to call it. These things occurred in Argentina very clearly. So there was complementary currencies, alternative currencies that were popping up. And, you know, of course, the government didn't like this, and they were fighting against these alternative currencies because it wasn't helping them or the overall situation from their perspective. Okay, but people had to live. Okay, so they had to feed their families. So they were going to do what they needed to do to get it done. By 2001, there was basically three factors that kind of all converged at the worst possible time. So you had the fixed exchange rate between the peso and the U.S. dollar, right? And so that did not help anything. There was large amounts of borrowing by the government. And you had a massive increase in debt due to reduced tax revenues, basically, because people, the economy was reducing. People were not making as much money. Therefore, tax revenues were reduced. Okay, so you had an increase in debt, increase in borrowing, and all of these things kind of worked together to basically start causing chaos. So we started having rate increases. So you had riots that were starting to occur. People were resigning left and right, and then we had the default of the government. All right. So even at one point, debt surpassed 50% of GDP. This was early on. And by the way, the United States has a 100% of GDP debt ratio. Okay, so in other words, our debt is just about equivalent to what our GDP is per year, which is a terrible number to have. So the IMF stepped in here. They advised the government, you need to balance your budget and you need to implement austerity measures. Of course, we don't do any of these things ourselves, but this is what the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, was telling the Argentine government to do. Balance your budget. Implement austerity measures in order to sustain investor confidence. Okay, because again, anytime you have an economy based on fiat money, you need confidence in order to make it work. So there was major cuts that occurred when the new administration came into place, and that was in 1999 into 2000. Unemployment rate was at 14%, so it actually had reduced slightly, but it's still very high. And projections of 3.5% GDP growth for the year. Okay, so things were, I guess, looking up in everyone's minds. They said, "Hey, we're going to have some growth. Unemployment has dropped a percentage point. We should be looking good." However, that didn't work out. Those numbers didn't pan out. It did not grow by 3.5% GDP, and the crisis accelerated. The growth projections were overly optimistic. Real GDP shrank by 0.8%, so it was negative 0.8%. And as a side note, and this is important to understand, is how does a nation determine GDP? Okay, and how does a nation determine inflation? How does a nation determine all these types of numbers? This is important because I'll tell you that the definition that the United States has used has changed over time. And it's changed in the favor of government. It hasn't changed in the favor of getting a real picture of the economy. It's changed so the numbers look better than what they actually are. So in other words, how we determined things like GDP, unemployment, inflation in 1986, for example, are completely different than they are today. And so in other words, if we applied the same measures of 1986 to today, the numbers would look a whole lot worse. Okay, so keep that in mind as we continue to go through this. So again, GDP shrank by 0.8%. Again, tax receipts were down, but the government was trying to freeze spending and they cut retirement benefits. This is getting into the 2000s now. This is also an interesting point here. Standard & Poor's, which is basically an independent company that rates people's ability to pay, so they'll rate countries with regards to bonds, etc. So what is it, what are they going to, what is their ability to be able to pay? And they actually placed Argentina on a credit watch. Okay, so that's bad news. That's basically saying, hey, we don't think that they're credit worthy, so that people need to be aware about lending them money. Treasury bills were going for 16% interest. And this is a huge number in order to be able to get to borrow any money. At this time, that was the second highest rate of any country in South America. And rising bond yields forced that country to turn to major international lenders such as the IMF, World Bank, and the U.S. Treasury. Okay, so these are the only entities, the only institutions that were lending them money: IMF, World Bank, U.S. Treasury. Several rounds of belt tightening followed, and more people were resigning due to basically nothing was being fixed. So they were resigning and being replaced by other people who had major plans and were trying much of the same things. To their credit, they were at least trying to implement, like I said, belt tightening, austerity measures, trying to reduce debt. Of course, none of that worked. And then Standard & Poor's in 2001 cut their credit rating to B, to bonds, their bonds, country's bonds, to B, which is not good. Okay, so the budget crisis was attempted to be fixed by an unpopular across-the-board pay cut in July of up to 13% to all civil servants and equivalent cut to government pension benefits. So it was basically a seventh austerity round. This triggered nationwide strikes, which didn't help anything, but it did further the depressed economy. It weakened it even more. The unemployment rate rose to 16.4% by August of 2001, and by December it was up to 20%. Public discontent with the economic conditions was expressed in a nationwide election. The President's Alliance lost seats in both chambers of their Congress, leaving it in the hands of the minority. And over 20% of voters chose to enter so-called anger votes by returning blank or defaced ballots rather than indicate support of any candidate. Well, by the end of 2001, people began withdrawing large sums of money from their bank accounts. Okay, they were turning pesos into dollars and sending them abroad, causing a bank run. Now, a bank run occurs especially in a fractional reserve banking system where there's a large number of customers withdrawing their deposits from a financial institution at the same time, and they're demanding their cash or a transfer of those funds into government bonds or precious metals. because they've lost confidence and they understand intuitively that that cash may not be there. Now, just real quick on fractional reserve banking, because this is what is practiced in the United States and pretty much every country in the world, so it's important to understand it. Well, it's just a practice when a bank holds reserves, a certain percentage of reserves that are obviously less than the amount of the customer's deposit. So when you deposit $1,000 into the bank, they're not keeping $1,000 in the bank for you. They keep a reserve amount. Now, the hope is that when if you want to go ahead and withdraw that $1,000, you will get it. But they don't necessarily have all that cash on hand. So those reserves are held as currency or as deposits in the bank's accounts because the bank deposits are usually considered money in their own right. So fractional reserve banking permits the money supply to grow. So that's the bottom line. It grows the money supply. So they're allowed to lend based on, you know, those percentages of reserves. So it's essentially growing the base amount of money. It's created. It's not actually there, but it's being used. So when they lend it all out, and it's, people go and buy boats and cars, and it furthers the growth type economy. Now, so to mitigate the risk of bank runs, which we saw here in Argentina, which is always a possibility, and in any country that's having serious economic problems, especially if it's systemic, if it's widespread, if it's extreme, most governments regulate and oversee commercial banks. They'll provide deposit insurance. This is why we have FDIC in the United States, and they'll act as a lender of last resort to commercial banks. Now, this is why most countries have central banks. I'm not saying this is a good thing. This is just why they have them, to include the United States, which is obviously the Fed. And they regulate bank credit creation. They impose and change. They'll tinker with reserve requirements and the ratios. And that can limit the amount of money creation that occurs in the banking system. They usually do that with those reserve requirements. And the idea is to make sure that banks are solvent and have enough funds to meet demand for withdrawals. So rather than directly limiting the money supply, central banks may pursue an interest rate target to control the amount a bank issues as far as credit. So that is a fractional reserve banking in a nutshell. Predictably, the government enacted measures to freeze all bank accounts for 12 months. Now, what they did is they didn't freeze it as in nobody can get anything from their accounts. They allowed for minor sums of cash to be withdrawn. So initially, something just think of something like, hey, they're going to let you withdraw $250 a week. So let's say you had $20,000 in your bank account. The government instituted these measures, and you can only withdraw a certain amount each week. So that's what happened there in Argentina. Obviously, not making people very happy, but this is what the government did to combat this issue. So all this freeze enraged Argentines. They took to the streets. They started rioting. Increased political turmoil, especially in Buenos Aires, and they engaged in these protests, and especially in 2001, 2002, end of 2001 and end of 2002, major demonstrations, property destruction, often directed at banks, foreign-owned private companies, especially American and European companies. Not sure exactly why there, but there was a perception that European and American companies were playing a part in their economic destruction. Major confrontations between police and citizens became common. Fires were set. A state of emergency was declared, and the situation even worsened. Continuing violent protests and clashes, demonstrators. Police ended up with several people dead, and this precipitated the fall of the government. And so that happened at the very end of 2001. And in fact, in the last week of 2001, the country defaulted on their public debt, totaling or equivalent to $132 billion U.S. And after a few months, the exchange rate the fixed exchange rate was ended. So, in other words, the peso was left to float more or less freely against the dollar. That caused an increase in inflation and in unemployment. So, in 2002, both of those figures started to go up pretty high. So, the accumulated inflation since that devaluation was about 80%. So the quality of life, as you can imagine, of the average Argentine was lowered proportionally. So many businesses closed, bankrupt, or went bankrupt. Imported products became virtually inaccessible, and salaries were left. So again, the quality of life went significantly down. And the supply of pesos did not meet the demand for cash. So again, you had complementary or alternative currencies. So they kept circulating alongside the peso. Fears of hyperinflation once again, it already happened twice over this period, as a consequence of devaluation, quickly eroded, which is obviously a good thing. And their acceptability ultimately depended on the state's willingness to take them as payment for taxes and other charges. So again, the state was forced to accept alternative currencies. Not that they wanted to, but they ended up doing it just based on the lack of supply of pesos. So eventually, Argentina recovered. And it was in 2003, based on some new elections. And I think some things just really worked together. It wasn't some magical politician who figured out exactly what to do. Some things worked together to help them to recover. So I think because of the devalued peso, it made the Argentine exports very cheap and competitive abroad. And it also discouraged imports. Okay, so that obviously helped them. And at that time, the price of soy on the international market was very high. And Argentina was able to produce a lot of soy. And China became a major buyer of Argentina's soy products. So these things kind of worked together to help them with the recovery. The peso slowly began to rise, reaching a 3-to-1 ratio with the dollar. Agricultural exports continued to grow in other places than just soy, and tourism actually returned. And if you think about it, it was very cheap to be a tourist in Argentina at that time. So that helped them at that time. There was a huge trade surplus in their favor, again, because of the devaluation. And again, I'm not suggesting that devaluation of the currency is good, because the fact of the matter was that the average quality of life for the Argentine was very low. But again, this did lead to a trade surplus, caused an inflow of dollars, and they were able to kind of stabilize the situation. So by December of 2005, foreign currency reserves had reached U.S. Equivalent of $28 billion. So this helped to stabilize the economy further. Their recovery was fairly strong. GDP jumped 8.8% in 2003, 9% in 2004, 9.2% in 2005, 8.5% in 2006, and 8.7% in 2007. This accompanied a wage increase, average annual increase that was pretty high. However, inflation ate away at these increases. 12.5% in 2005, 10% in 2006, nearly 15% in 2007, and over 20% during 2008. The government was accused of manipulating inflation statistics, leading, for example, The Economist magazine had to turn to private sources instead of following government sources. I wonder if The Economist magazine does the same thing as opposed to government statistics in the United States. Okay, with all that said, Argentina has, or it did recover during that time. Today they have major problems. Quite frankly, they're ranked 166th on the Economic Index of Freedom. They almost defaulted in July of this year when they were forced to pay full interest on bonds for hedge funds that they had done some swaps with. But anyway, with that being said, the real point of today is not only to take a peek at history, but also to garner some lessons learned. So let's talk about those real quick. And understand this, that what we're looking at today is the macro lessons from the Argentine Depression, not the micro lessons. There was a ton of lessons to be learned from that, looking at the micro perspective. For example, the loss of power during this time for many people that weren't used to that, or the uptick in crime and how people tended to protect themselves, and urban versus rural, things like that. So that's not what we're talking about today. We're talking about some of the macro lessons. And then the first one I want to talk about is that the Argentine government gives us insight into what a desperate government is capable of, and what could come to any nation on the planet, to include the United States. During this time, the Argentine government confiscated retirement accounts. They devalued the currency on purpose. They put capital controls in place. They put controls on banks. All of those aspects that we talked about, they did. And the lesson learned there is that any government is capable of doing those things, to include the U.S. government. And so you have to understand that. I'm not suggesting that we don't operate inside of our current system. But just understand that these things happen, and governments will do whatever they need to do to maintain the status quo. Okay, that's it. They have done it in the past, and they will do it again. And quite frankly, the government will not take into effect any ethical considerations when they stop you from accessing money in your own bank account. Okay, so that's it's an important lesson learned in this case. The second one is that governments will manipulate the currency. Okay, they do manipulate currencies, and will. And whether that's, usually it's in the case of devaluing the currency. So you need to think of that in mind and prepare for that. So what do I mean by that? Well, for one, you should be diversified in your investments. Should you invest? Absolutely. I'm not someone who says, no, that you shouldn't invest anything. But here's what diversification is not. Diversification is not when you have four different mutual funds. That is not diversification. I know that's what conventional wisdom tells us, but it's simply not true. That is putting all of your money inside of paper assets, which I think is a terrible idea. Now, I'm not faulting anyone or saying that they're wrong if they want to invest in mutual funds. That's fine. I personally do not. I pulled out of, that's what I used to do, index funds, and that's great. So if that's what you want to do, more power to you. I don't do it anymore. Okay. What I would recommend to somebody, if they, in addition to investing in mutual funds or in any other manner in the stock market or whatever, if that's what you want to do, is that have some other types of holdings. So invest in other areas. Invest in physical assets. Invest in real estate. Invest in business ownership. Invest in tools and machinery that you can use to make money or invest in skills. You know, all of these are very non-conventional investments, but they are investments. Invest in precious metals. That's true diversification. And you can have some money in the stock market and mutual funds and whatever else. Okay, that is diversification. Most people think of diversification today as in, oh, I'm in four different types of mutual funds. One of them is small cap, mid cap, and large cap. That's not diversification. Okay, the next lesson learned is about understanding fiat currency. And we talked about this with regards to the Argentine crisis. And the reality is we have to use, or we are using, fiat currency. That's the system we're in. I don't think we're going to get away from it anytime soon. Although there are some measures in places in the world where people are trying to get back to a currency that's backed by something tangible, which is a good thing. But that's not the reality that we face here in the United States. But understanding that fiat currency is simply based on confidence. Okay, there's nothing wrong with having a medium of exchange for goods and services, and that's what the dollar does for us. It's an easily divisible medium of exchange. Okay, it is not real money. It is not. Okay, it is again, that facilitates medium of exchange. Fiat currency is based on confidence. Lose confidence and the currency is in trouble. Now, what is seemingly helping us to maintain our currency as a powerhouse in the world? It's the fact that we are the world's reserve currency. Everybody uses dollars. They either match it to their own currencies. They, in some cases, will use our currency as their national money. In the case of places like Palau, Palau is its own country, but it uses the dollar as its currency. And it's obviously pegged to, you know, the value of the dollar. And so there's lots of places like that as well. But you need to understand that. And so that should give you a mindset to, again, diversify in your investments, which I highly recommend. The other lesson learned here is talking about banks. I'm not anti-bank. I'm not suggesting you don't use a bank. I use a bank. But the reality is that banks are subject to these types of government controls. Bank holidays are not unheard of. They've happened in U.S. history many different times. The Great Depression, 9/11, and it will likely happen again at some point. And it's not unrealistic to think that the government could step in and control the amount that you can withdraw, etc. If you look at the recent Greek bank issue, they actually, when they call it a haircut, they basically just took a portion of everybody's deposits. Okay, that is not out of the realm of possibility. So just to understand that. So again, don't put all of your eggs in one basket. Don't put all of your money in the bank. Certainly, you know, we have our own, we have an emergency fund. And our emergency fund is or at least part of it is in the bank. So again, I'm not suggesting don't use the bank, but understand its vulnerabilities and take the necessary precaution. The good news is that these situations, economic problems, you know, rise and fall. And if we look at the case of Argentina, you know, during that time between 1998 and 2002, during that 4 to 5 year period, man, it was terrible. And for certain families or certain individuals, it must have seemed like the end of the world. But they did come out the other side, and hopefully, a lot of lessons learned came from it for them, and that they're stronger for it. However, government is also cyclical in that manner, and that we tend to forget the lessons learned. And in fact, they're having major problems now with a heavy-handed government getting deep into the economy with their controls and everything else, and they're seeing the fruit from that once again, as opposed to a free market economy. And then one more lesson learned is that when these types of things happen, alternative currencies and alternative markets will appear. They will. So in a lot of cases, in fact, in Argentina today, with the numbers looking so terrible, the reality is that people are doing what they have to do to survive. So they're operating in alternative markets. You call it a black market if you want. They're operating with alternative currencies because they can't trust the government currency because of the manipulation, or at least they're diversified and maybe doing multiple currencies, which is not a bad idea. If you look at today, what do we have? We have lots of alternative currencies that are popping up, even in the United States. Okay, we have things like Bitcoin. There's all kinds of alternative local currencies that are popping up that people are using, which I think is a great thing. So just be aware of that and pay attention to what's going around you. And so those are some lessons learned, I think, that we can take from the Argentine depression, apply it to ourselves and our own lives, look at our own government, and just have a cautious eye on them in order to be resilient in our lives. Our scripture for today comes from Romans chapter 2, verse 1. Therefore you have no excuse, O man, every one of you who judges, for in passing judgment on another, you condemn yourself, because you, the judge, practice the very same things. This concludes today's podcast. Thanks for listening. Please visit us on our website, thecourageouslifepodcast.com. We'd appreciate any comments or questions that you have. And also like us on Facebook, The Courageous Life Podcast. Semper Fidelis and Soli Deo Gloria.